You're listening to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. I'm Garrett Ashley Mullet, and I want to talk about everything. Welcome back to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show. This is, of course, Garrett Ashley Mullet coming to you from Greeley, Colorado for episode 503 of this podcast. Today is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. That means tomorrow is Thanksgiving here in the United States of America. And I'll be honest with you, before we get into the main topic, I have not slept well. I did not sleep well last night. I didn't sleep well the night before. I believe I mentioned in our last episode that my family was coming down with something. We were getting sick. And sure enough, we have all been sick. And some of us still are. Some of us are through it. And on the other end, some of us still are very much diminished, still coughing, still having a hard time getting comfortable and sleeping through the night. And that goes especially for our youngest, right? Our youngest, Andrew, he is not quite one. He's getting closer. His birthday's in January, but he's not quite one. And he has just not been resting well. And so that means, by extension, my wife, Lauren, and I have not been resting well. We've not been sleeping well. Well, last night, I tried to alleviate this. I could tell, you know, waking up in the middle of the night for the dozenth time, it seemed like, probably not that often, but it, you know, it was quite often. It was at least once an hour, maybe a couple times an hour. My wife was just not, you know, not getting any rest. And so I said, well, why don't I just go ahead and take him? I'll see if I can, you know, buy you time, right? Buy you some sleep. I'll go in my office with him and maybe do some reading or watch something. And so I did, right? So Andrew and I came into my office and then began the always difficult decision-making process. What are we going to watch, right? What do we want to watch? And I thought, you know, I'm not feeling well. Andrew's not feeling well. Maybe something not too serious, something that, you know, it's not going to be the worst thing ever if I am not firing on all cylinders, and if I miss out, or if I fall asleep myself while we're watching, what would be maybe a good option? Well, scrolling through Hulu, scrolling through Amazon Prime, I saw a title that looked at least somewhat interesting. And I thought to myself, I've never seen that. It's probably a very campy movie. But, you know, maybe that's just the ticket, right? Not so interesting that I'm going to regret falling asleep if I fall asleep or hold off on it. But, you know, interestingly enough, you know, if it's interesting enough that I know the name of it, it's been around for quite some time. 1982, I think, is when it came out. You know, I'll at least be able to say that I've seen it, right? Even if I say I fell asleep while I was watching it. So we watched, and sure enough, I mean, it's not a great film. I mean, it's really a B movie, if not a C movie. I mean, it's just cheesy and poorly written and campily acted. And, it's just not that great of a movie. I'm sorry. For anybody who loves it, I'll pray for you, but it's just not that great of a movie. But it doesn't make you appreciate, right? It makes you appreciate when movies are quite good, that there are bad movies that are poorly made, which just goes to show there's a spectrum. It's not a foregone conclusion that movies are going to be well made and well told and well shown and all that. But you know, one interesting thing that I did pick up on in watching Beastmaster was that the main villain, Max, you know, this high priest of this pagan god, Max is the villain in part because he wants to sacrifice children, right? He wants to kill children and offer them as a human sacrifice to his evil pagan god. And kind of the climax of the movie, the very tail end, right before the hero achieves total victory, features this Mayax character at the top of a pyramid sacrificing children, right? One successfully, and then another one attempted, but then he's stopped. And I thought, you know, that's, boy, like, it's such a curious thing that you've got this villain who stands up above all the other people and promises, you know, if you don't offer me your children to sacrifice to this god, then, you know, this god's going to be angry and we will not prosper and it'll be all your fault because you withheld the blood of your children from this god. And you knew, right? I warned you, but we're not going to let that happen. I'm going to forcibly take your children from you and then murder them. And it's for the greater good. You'd better not cross me or, you know, you're going to be also sacrificed. You know, it struck me that actually, as far-fetched a plot as that is, it's not distant enough from the reality that we live in these days, where children are sacrificed for our prosperity. Am I right? I mean, children are sacrificed for the prosperity of their parents. And if anyone objects to the sacrifice of children, they are shouted down, well, we'll come get you too, right? We can't have anything getting in the way of our prosperity, even though at the exact same time, it's somehow this horrible, awful thing that we want to be prosperous, right? So it's kind of a pick one thing if it's supposed to make sense, but then that's just it. It's not supposed to make sense. It's evil, and the unreasonableness is the point. And the confusion on your part is the point, and the fear that you're feeling, and the destruction that's being sown, that is the point. And the point is not prosperity, and it's not even, first and foremost, to get you to knuckle under. The point is to destroy, right? This is the enemy of our souls working to bring about our ruination because he hates God and we're made in God's image. That's really what it's about. So that's not far-fetched, right? That is what's actually happening, but it's curious that this movie, The Beastmaster, is made in such an implausible way, and yet that might just be one of the things that kind of redeems it, that, he's protecting children, right? He's against the guy who wants to murder children to increase prosperity or because he's just a sadomasochist or whatever, right? Okay, cool. Now you have my attention. Right now, I can root for this Beastmaster character. That's great. You know, actually, interestingly enough, so that was, I mean, I guess I could say last night. It's 5 in the morning now, but I feel like I've been up all night. The night before last, actually, was when we watched Beastmaster, Andrew and I. And he didn't really care for it. He didn't sleep hardly a wink. It was not a... Not a winner in his book, I guess you could say. But actually last night, not 2 nights ago when we watched The Beastmaster, but actually last night, I watched another movie with him because it was kind of second verse, same as the first. He wasn't sleeping well. That meant by extension that Lauren and I were not sleeping hardly at all, especially Lauren. So I offered to take him. First, I said, hey, well, you know, maybe we should try a breathing treatment because he's been sick and he's coughing and he's just really congested. So maybe let's try that, right? Because I have a nebulizer. I have asthma. I have a nebulizer with some albuterol. And sure enough, I think it did help. It didn't help soon enough for us to all stay in bed and sleep the rest of the night. But I think... it helped enough, it kicked in enough by the time I actually took him to my office and found something to watch that he fell sound asleep. And he slept the entire way through No Time to Die. So No Time to Die, as you may know, is a much more recent film. It was just released last year. It's the last film in the Daniel Craig 007 series, James Bond series of films, No Time to Die. It actually was originally supposed to come out, I believe, in 2020. And then COVID hit, and then they postponed because they didn't want to release with COVID keeping people out of theaters. And I think there also might have been something to do with, you know, needing to finish up shooting the film, that it just wasn't, it wasn't feasible, right? It wasn't feasible for them to do what they needed to do one way or the other. So they released it 2021. And it's a long movie. But, you know, again, whatever far-fetched quality James Bond flicks have sometimes, and the older they are, the longer ago they were made, the more that's the case. I'd say Daniel Craig's James Bond is the most plausible, the most realistic. But whatever implausibility, whatever you might say as far as feeling disconnected and emotionally detached from James Bond, yeah, he's cool, but so what, right? What's he fighting for? What's he doing now? Oh, it's another woman. Oh, it's another drink. Oh, it's another way to die for his villains, his enemies. This film, actually, I think it was something special compared with all the other James Bond films. And, you know, and it really wasn't the action sequences. Those have always been quite good. You know, it wasn't the chase scenes and the nice cars and the motorcycles and the helicopters. No, those have always been quite good, I think. It wasn't the shooting and the martial arts and all that. No, it was a reason, right? It was a reason. Very similar to Beastmaster. It was the motivation. It was, and I, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the film yet, if you plan on seeing the film yet, and you don't want me to ruin anything for you, just stop right now, fast forward 5 minutes, and you'll be fine. But come to find out, in watching No Time to Die, which picks up, obviously, where the last film left off, Daniel Craig's James Bond has had a child with Madeline Swan, Dr. Swan, from the last film. They've had a child, but then they've been apart for 5 years, so he didn't even know. He didn't know that he had a child with her. He thought she betrayed him, and so he put her on a train and said, "You'll never see me again," and then come to find out, "Oh, yes, you will." And then he realizes he's still in love with her. Perhaps for the first time, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but perhaps for the first time in any of the James Bond franchise films, I heard James Bond hear, "I love you." And I heard his love interest, so-called. They're always called love interest. But in this case, it actually felt real, right? Like he said to her, "I love you too," right? He was ready to die in order to save the love of his life and their daughter. And I won't give any more away than that. That's, you know, quite enough. But saving the world is one thing. Saving the world... It's whatever. You know what's really special? Saving the love of your life. That's really special. What's really special is saving your child. That's really special. Saving the world is whatever. Saving the woman you love. That's really something. Saving your daughter. That's really something. And so I'm not ashamed to admit, I wept. And I don't do that with films very often. I didn't do it with Beastmaster, right? I don't do that with every film. If I would have wept at Beastmaster, it would have been because it's such a bad movie. But in the case of No Time to Die, I wept at how moving this was and how much of a departure from so much of James Bond lore and persona I've been familiar with, and you know, watching, I think, most of the movies over the years. It was in that moment that he said, "I love you too," and did what he did at the tail end. Again, sorry, not to give anything away, but saving the woman he loved, saving his daughter, their daughter. It was in that moment that I thought to myself, you're alive right now. Even if you're about to die, you're alive right now. And that's really fantastic. That's fantastic to see. It's one thing to die, but it reminds me of what the Apostle Paul writes in Corinthians about how we can give all that we have, you know, sell all that we have and give the proceeds to the poor. But if we have love, that's what actually makes it count. And if you don't have love, it's nothing, right? It's nothing. It's worthless. You can give up your body to be burned at the stake. You could die this horrible, awful death of a martyr. And if you have love, well, then it counts for something. But if you don't, well, then it's just, it's senseless. It's whatever. You know, so also with regards to heroic action, hard work, effort, concentrated attention, what we build, what we invest in, what we're seeking to accomplish, what we're seeking to leave behind us. With love, it's worth something, right? If we love God, if we love one another, if we love our neighbors, we love ourselves, then that is worth something. If we don't have that, though, if we don't have love, it's worthless. It's nothing. And it's not really living either. You've got to live to love God and those others who've been made in his image, who he's put in your proximity, he's put in your path, he's put next to you. But all of that brings us to the main topic, interestingly enough. Some of the jokes about arguably the main character we'll be talking about in this episode really actually compare him to a Bond supervillain. Klaus Schwab, as you may know if you have heard of him, he is the executive chairman for life of the World Economic Forum. He founded it back in 1971. Lots of very odd things happened in 1971, by the way. But one of them, among others, the founding of the WEF by German engineer, economist, founder of the WEF, Klaus Martin Schwab. He actually was born 1938 in Ravensburg, German Reich, now Germany. He was born in Nazi Germany and grew up, did well for himself, became well-educated. He's got an academic background, honorary degrees, honorary doctorates, multiple from the London School of Economics, for instance, the National University of Singapore, for instance, the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology, for instance. Also, he has been awarded the French Legion of Honor, the Grand Cross with Star of the National Order of Germany, the Japanese Grand Cordon of the Order of the Rising Sun, also the Dan David Prize, and was knighted by Queen Elizabeth, Knight Commander of the Order of St. Michael and St. John. He's got a lot of important connections. If you check out his Wikipedia page, you'll see him shaking hands at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum with Russian President Vladimir Putin. If you take a look at his resume on here, you'll see he's been a major player on the world scene for 50 years. There's a concerning quality to what he's advocating, what he's been advocating. There's a lot of very murky suspicion that essentially he wants to set up a one-world government. I don't even know if you can call it a suspicion. It's pretty well established. He's pretty well said it. He's invited to speak at the G20 here recently, G20, B20 in Indonesia. And he gets up and he gives a short address, which I watched, I listened to. I've been hearing about this whole Great Reset business. I've been reading up a little bit on the history of the Federal Reserve. And, you know, there's a book right now I'm nearly done with, The Creature from Jekyll Island. But before I read that, began reading that. I read None Dare Call It Conspiracy, there's another work that's up next in the queue, maybe after a break, maybe after an intermission, but Mark Morano's The Great Reset, Global Elites and the Permanent Lockdown. I want to be careful that I don't get sucked into something that really can't be proven or disproven. But I'll tell you what, all this business about the WEF and Davos and the Bilderberg Group and the richest men in the world, the elites of the world, getting together on a regular basis to discuss re-engineering the way that the world works, the way it operates, everything. You'll own nothing and be happy, that kind of stuff. There's nothing quite like just listening to what's being said directly. Not what's being said about these kinds of folks and their meetings, but what do they say themselves in their own words. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play a bit of this speech by Klaus Schwab. He's speaking here, as I said, at the G20 B20 2022 in Indonesia. Don't take it from me. Give a listen to this summit keynote address titled Harnessing the Power of Innovation for Future Economic Growth.
Excellencies, distinguished participants of this very important meeting. Let me first congratulate the government, the president government of Indonesia, for exercising such a great hospitality for all of us who are here. I would also like to express my admiration for the quality of the preparation of this B20 meeting. It reminds me, actually, in 2010, I proposed to the chair of the G20 at that time, the Korean chairmanship, to integrate a strong business dimension into the deliberations of the G20. Because I deeply believe into the multi-stakeholder concept, which means we all have to work together, corporations, of course governments, civil society, to address the big issues in our world. Let me just make four remarks related to generating growth through innovation. First, of course, if you look at all the challenges, we can speak about a multi-crisis, an economic, a political, a social, an ecological, an institutional crisis. But actually, what we have to confront is a deep, systemic, and structural restructuring of our world. And this will take some time. And the world will look differently after we have gone through this transition process. Politically, the driving forces for this political transformation, of course, is the transition into a multipolar world, which has a tendency to make our world much more fragmented. And for these reasons, events like this one, the G20, and so on, are the very important connectors to avoid a too great segmentation, I would say, blockization instead of globalization of our world. If you look at the economic transformation forces, I just would like to mention four. The energy transition, which we need, and where Indonesia is playing a very important role. Second, the reshaping of our supply chains, where Indonesia can play a very important role. Then I would also say the integration of external costs. Just look at plastics. 10 billion tons a year of plastics are moving into our oceans. And for this reason, I'm so pleased that on the occasion of this G20, B20 meeting, we can announce and inaugurate an O20 to take better care of our oceans. But in addition to the reshaping of our supply chains, of the energy transformation, of internalization of external costs, we also see the consequences of militarization of our economies. Now, this all means, at least at the beginning, a cost burden. Now, if you restructure a company, you write off the costs, and of course, the shareholders are suffering. If you restructure an economy, the result is a reduction of income, of disposable income, which can lead to extensive social tensions, which we see in our world developing. Now, how do we deal with this transition, which may last for several years? Not just applying crisis management, not just reacting, but constructing the future with a purpose. We should use this transition time with a clear concept of what we want to achieve, how we want to come out of this transition time. We want to come out as a more sustainable, more resilient, and more inclusive world.
Okay, so let's just stop right there. What are we dealing with here? As I said, this is Klaus Schwab, founder, executive chairman, probably for life. I don't know. I guess I don't know that he is going to be the executive chairman for life, but I would presume at this point, given how long he's been at the helm of the World Economic Forum, he's the founder of the WEF, which since 1971 has been trying to get us more globalized in our politics, economics, etc. There's the G20, which is what? And then there's the B20, which is related. First of all, the G20, also known as the Group of 20, it's an intergovernmental forum comprising 19 countries, per Wikipedia, 19 countries and the EU. It works to address major issues related to the global economy, such as international financial stability, climate change mitigation, and sustainable development. That's a direct quote. It is composed of most of the world's largest economies, including both industrialized and developing nations. It accounts for about 80% of gross world product, GWP, 59 to 77% of international trade, two-thirds of the global population, 60% of the world's land area. Who all is in it? In alphabetical order, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Italy, Japan, Mexico, South Korea, Russia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Turkey, the UK, the United States, and the EU, also known as the European Union. So a lot of major countries, important countries, including but not limited to the EU and the United States. All of North America, plus particular countries around the world who are regarded as strategically vital to their regions. What is the B20? Well, the B20, in short, is the corresponding summit of business leaders. So the G20 is your political leaders for the most part. Also, as I understand it, finance ministers, central bank governors also are in the mix here. Not just heads of state, but also heads of economies, yeah, insofar as regulation, control of the flow of money, circulation of money, distribution of money, lending, that's also very central. And that is how you move economies, is you move money. Also, another way you move economies is you get the business leaders together and you, for one, flatter them. You say, ah, yes, you are very important. Also, in some sense, you threaten and cajole and prod them. You need to be a team player. You need to be on board with what it is that we're trying to do here. So here's Klaus Schwab saying what the big idea is. We are going to engineer the future, not just for our countries, but for the world. Now, interestingly enough, not every country in the world is a part of this G20. There are plenty of countries, lots of countries that are not part of this G20. There's a lot of the world that is not sitting at the table as an equal participant, but you have the strongest. So that's a curious thing just from the get-go, that it's not everybody. It's not everybody who's going to have an equal say. It is these wealthy, important, powerful men. And to some extent, who is or isn't invited is part of how you enact the plan. But you're supposed to hear, if you're on board with all of this, that this is for the greater good. This is for the betterment of mankind. This is for saving the planet. You hear him hinting at maybe an O20 that's coming down the pike if they get their way, if they have their druthers, where you're going to have 20 countries that get together and they save the oceans. So first we got to save the planet more broadly, and then we've got to do something about our oceans, get them cleaned up, invite the countries to the table who are especially invested in having an impact on the oceans. Now, I think that's probably a lot of the same names, honestly, because international trade via waterways, very cost effective, very efficient. That is part of how the countries that are the biggest and the most powerful and the most wealthy have a seat at this G20 table in the first place. But I didn't get an invite. Did you get an invite? No, of course not. So this isn't for you and me. Whatever altruistic jargon, verbiage, vision we're being told is at the core here, there's just a practical reality that not everybody is going to get their way. And also, there's a plain fact that they're not at the G20, B20. They're not looking for ways to implement a conservative vision. Now, they would see themselves, clearly, as conservators after a fashion. But in some sense, there's nothing new here. There's no new thing under the sun. They are conquerors. So it's kind of like the euphemism that if I'm playing Civilization VI, I might use, or somebody I'm playing with might use. If you see a settler who is on their way, but untended, unguarded, to go and found a new city in some unclaimed part of the world, I or some other player might decide to take that settler under our protection, also known as capturing that settler, and then we found the city, and then it's part of our country, right? I'm liberating this settler and inviting them to be a part of my empire. They will come under my protection. Call it what you will, but it's no new thing under the sun. It is conquest. It is world domination. It is a kind of dominion, but like I said, it's not dominion of the folks who want to implement a conservative vision or a Christian vision. It's folks who want to see a one-world government that abolishes poverty, mental illness, inequity, want, strife, war. This is the internationalists. This is not a new idea. Broadly speaking, throughout history, that you would have a power that desires to conquer the whole world. This is just the latest iteration of that timeless ambition. Also, too, listen to what's being said about the crisis of the moment and how it can be useful. There's a lot of disruption. There's a lot of factors that are in flux. But Klaus Schwab says, let's not be reactive. Let's use this to plan the future that we want to come out on the other end with. He talks about if a corporation is restructuring during a merger or an acquisition. Well, that is to say that you recognize, Klaus, that you are acquiring. You are gaining something that you did not have. You are buying up things that did not belong to you previously. You are expanding your holdings, so to speak, which already would be quite extensive. 1 million Swiss francs, I understand, is his annual salary. According to Wikipedia, he's come under a great deal of scrutiny for that fact, because that's a lot of money. I mean, that's a very, very handsome compensation package for putting together the world's economies, bringing about a one-world government. It pays well, of course. One would expect nothing less. But he says, you know, if this were a corporation and you were restructuring, well, then there would be external costs that you internalize, and shareholders in the corporation would have to accept that they're not going to be as handsomely rewarded during that transition period as they otherwise would have been. We have to shuffle some things around. We have to reallocate funds that otherwise would have been paid out to those shareholders so that we can make this restructured entity successful, stable, self-supporting. Only in this case, I mean, he doesn't just leave it mysterious. He says flat out, the shareholders, so to speak, are the citizens of these countries which are being restructured. These economies that are being restructured are comprised of men and women and children who, it's no secret to Klaus Schwab and the WEF and the G20 and the B20 and the future O20, whoever will be involved in that, they will have to be on board with this vision. Otherwise, they won't be invited, I'm sure. It's no secret to them that a reduced standard of living is part and parcel. They know that you're getting squeezed financially, materially. Inflation is the means of redistributing your wealth, my wealth, our economic wherewithal, our capacity. In other words, insofar as this is a global effort, your money is being shipped overseas in the name of equity, inclusivity, diversity, in the name of a one-world government push, which is now, depending on when you want to chart it from, between 50 and 100 years old. Let's say that it started in earnest with World War I, continuing on through World War II. The League of Nations was toothless and didn't really do what it was said to be about doing. So then you have World War II, you have war as a mechanism of diplomacy and resolving disputes, outlawed internationally, at least aggressive war, defensive war, that's one thing. Aggressive war, oh no, 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 you can't do that. We will all come for you. We will all declare war on you if you declare aggressive war. But then World War II comes and goes, concludes with the repulsion of Imperial Japan, Nazi Germany, the Third Reich, Benito Mussolini's fascist government in Italy. Then you have the Cold War. And in the midst of the Cold War, you have WEF, the World Economic Foundation. In the midst of the Cold War, you have this alternative path charted to accomplishing world peace. Not necessarily instead of the United Nations, but in conjunction with. this is the select core group that's going to make sure the levers of economic power are pushed and pulled, the buttons are pressed, the dials are turned to accomplish the goal. And then COVID happens, right? 2020, it's a major upset. Everything gets shut down. And conditions are put on opening back up in various places. It's a crisis. And as long as you can keep the crisis going, well, then you can put the screws to people, men, women, children, whole economies, whole countries. If you want this to stop, let us do what we want with the global economy. You want to be able to get back to school. You want to be able to get back to work. You want to be able to get back to church. You want to be able to get back to meeting with your family. You're going to have to do what we want you to do. It just so happens part of what they want us to do is become more diverse, inclusive, equitable. They say DEI, but all those letters also can be rearranged. D-I-E, die, right? So there's a kind of destruction that is, I think, not a bug. I think it's a feature of this. You know, going back to the business with the last film in Daniel Craig's James Bond series, you know, it's funny to me, we can have movies like this coming out for years. We can have stories like this being told for years, written, turned into movies, made the plots of TV shows. Again and again, you have the damaged but self-confident genius who thinks they know what's wrong with the world and how to fix it. And so they're going to save the world even if they are curing the disease by killing the patient. So again, spoiler alert, stop now if you don't want me to give anything away for No Time to Die. The big super weapon is in this last James Bond film, nanobots that target specific genetics. So the DNA banks of countries around the world have been hacked. Genetic information on individuals across the world has been sequenced and stored. And then you calibrate these nanobots to target only people who have certain genetic markers for elimination. The nanobots, if they find a match, they wreak havoc and they terminate the individuals with the DNA that is being targeted by the person releasing the weapon. The British government, via MI6, their spy force that James Bond is a part of, that he's an agent of, they have this weapon being developed with the help of a captured scientist, because it's going to be a lot cleaner to eliminate threats using this weapon as opposed to sending special agents like 007 after bad actors. It's going to be a lot safer. You won't have to risk the life of a 00 agent. You can just release this weapon in a very targeted way, and it will only eliminate the individual you're going after. No collateral damage, very clean, until the weapon is stolen. Of course it's stolen. That's always what happens. The weapon is developed, and then it's stolen by some madman, crazy, evil character who has other ideas for possible uses of it. He's going to use it to kill millions and millions and millions of people. Which millions? Who knows? Doesn't matter. It's evil. He needs to be stopped. He is stopped. But some of the dialogue back and forth between Mr. Bond and the main villain, towards the very end of the film, Bond is trying to reason with him. And he says, you know, you're just the latest, right? You're not new. You're the latest small man who has big ambitions. It never ends well for men who try to play God. Don't you know that? And this villain, the supervillain, Lucifer Safin, seems like we can't quite get away from making this guy into the Satan character. There's not a lot of difference between his name and Lucifer Satan, like evil, evil. He says, oh, you play God all the time. You kill people. You have a license to kill. We're pretty much the same. Right? What's the difference? Here again, we should be reminded that not being able to tell the difference between the guy who's just killing people he thinks are in the way of perfection, if we can't tell the difference between that guy and the one trying to save his beloved and his daughter, and if we can't tell the difference between those two men, then I think something broken. Well, there's something broken about the main villain in this film, and there's something broken about us if we're of the same mind. But I listen to this Klaus Schwab speech, and I think, boy, this sounds an awful lot like not just the accent that might be preferred for a lot of Bond villains, a German accent, what else? Or a Russian accent, that would also work. The substance of the ideas here. Yes, people are going to be harmed economically. Their standard of living is going to go down. This is going to raise tension between people and in society. But that's the cost, right? You can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. It'll be worth it in the end. That's always how these men think and reason. It's always about the world. But you know what's better than saving the world or dominating the world, taking over the world, getting your revenge on the world? What's better than that? Loving, protecting, providing for your beloved, your daughter. I mean, you can't make up the German accent. It's too on the nose. He does sound like a supervillain from a James Bond film. He does. He may be a supervillain from a James Bond film. I'm not sure. But a little later on, he talks about using the metaverse to facilitate global dialogue. Well, that's great, right? Nothing wrong with global dialogue. But see, the problem is, it's almost like these folks have never seen a Michael Crichton film or a James Bond flick. They've never seen these things. They are totally unfamiliar with how cliche they're being. These are always euphemisms in the mouths of villains. Global dialogue. Who would be against that? We already have global dialogue. When you want to be the ones behind the global dialogue, moderating the global dialogue, and then you say, like he does, you're looking for a more inclusive world. Inclusivity here is code for us all being pressured to affirm and tolerate things that we don't believe are true or correct. It's just like sustainability. He uses that term as well, sustainability. That's code for you enduring arbitrary redistributions of your wealth and power to people you will never know because this guy said so. Of course he takes his cut. A million francs a year. It's not cheap having somebody competent to bring about a one-world government. Now, interestingly enough, when he talks about a standard of living being compressed and contracting and tension rising and shareholders needing to just accept that they'll own nothing and be happy. You know, what's curious is I don't see him feeling any apparent tension that he's talking about. If he's making a million francs a year, he could definitely lead the way and be the first to give up his salary. But of course, that's not the way these things work. They're always euphemisms. They're always rules for thee, but not for me. He talks of stakeholder responsibility for corporations. If you've heard of ESG scores, that's where they come into play. He talks about taking care of the planet. That's the front for a one-world government, which has communism as its premise. In order for a government to be big enough, strong enough to save the planet, that government has to govern the entire planet and it has to take the planet away from you. That means, yes, as we have heard, the year is 2030, and you own nothing, and you're happy. You will own nothing, and you will be happy. Or what? Or what? You'll be encouraged to in a sustainable way, I'm sure, in the interest of inclusivity. These are euphemisms. You know, I think of this whole hubbub here recently with regards to FTX, this exchange for cryptocurrency that was run by the second leading most donor to Democrats. SBF is his shorthand, nickname, Sam Bankman-Fried. Michael Knowles had a guy on who was something of a cryptocurrency expert to explain to the Daily Wire audience what just happened here, right? I don't understand how cryptocurrency works, and is this the result of not enough regulation or too much regulation, the wrong kind of regulation? Like, what's the deal? And the way it was broken down is it's really not complicated, right? The guy that's this expert on crypto, he says it's really not complicated. There's nothing new about this. There's nothing newfangled. There's nothing original. It's just theft. It's just fraud. That's not a new thing. Actually, what contributed to this being possible was the perception in the market among people who were not terribly well informed and weren't paying attention that because SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, was close to a lot of regulators in Washington, D.C., a lot of Democrat politicians in Washington, D.C., he was donating to their campaigns, he was buddies with them. Of course, they're going to be buddies right back. Because he had a close working relationship with regulators, therefore FTX was safe. So it wasn't that there wasn't any regulation. It was that this guy scammed people who entrusted their money to him. And then he took that money and he gave it to another company to cover their losses because they had made some bad bets. They had made some bad investments. They were over-leveraged. And he was going to try and rescue by taking money out of FTX to cover. Oh, whoops. Wait a second. Now word is getting out. Now everybody's trying to pull their money out of FTX. Now FTX is collapsing, just like a run on the bank. Everybody tries to pull their money out. Fractional reserve banking, as I'm learning in The Creature from Jekyll Island, fractional reserve banking is how this happens. You print money. You don't have to have the actual specie in a vault anywhere. You can keep 1/10, 1/100th of the actual wealth, and then the rest you can just loan out at interest. And then you can borrow, you can loan it to yourself, you can print more, you have more and more and more and more resting on less and less and less. And it's a scam. It's fraud. A lot of people look at this stuff and they think, man, this is so complicated. I just don't understand it. I must just not be very smart. No, no. If it's confusing and it doesn't make any sense, that could also be because this is a scam. It doesn't add up because it's a scam. Not that crypto's a scam. Not that taking an interest in how your business dealings are going to affect pollution or people in some other country, not that that's a scam, but some guy who makes $1,050,000 a year, because that's what the exchange rate is, by the way. If you were wondering, I kept talking 1 million Swiss francs per year that Klaus Schwab is paid. That's his salary for being founder and head of the WEF. If you were wondering how many U.S. dollars that is, it's 1 Swiss franc to 1.05 U.S. dollars. So he makes over $1 million a year. It's a huge salary. That guy wants to lecture you about you needing to tighten your belt. John Kerry and Al Gore want to fly all over the world propagandizing populations to vote for politicians and governments that will get on board with redistributing your wealth to save you from a drought or wildfire season or flood or monsoon or a blizzard, from the weather, right? It's brilliant, right? Convince people that you give them money, you give them your children's money, you give them your children. Now we're full circle. We're right back to Beastmaster. 1982, terrible B movie. Give them your children or the gods are going to be very angry. Disaster will befall you. This is no new thing under the sun. This is just the latest iteration. Now, interestingly enough, some of what's baked into the pie here explicitly, you might think, well, Garrett, maybe you're connecting some dots that really don't go together. Talking about communism, really? Communism's not real. That's just a story told to children to frighten them. You know, you'd better be good or communism will get you. No, 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 no. John Kerry spills the beans at UN's COP27 meeting, some reporting by Jim Hoft over at Gateway Pundit from November 10th. They want to replace capitalism with a new economic system. The World Economic Forum's climate change agenda was modeled off the effort to roll out vaccines during the COVID pandemic, John Kerry said during a COP27 panel discussion in Egypt on Tuesday. That means we can all look forward to high-pressure course of government tactics, and not only from the government, but from corporate elites. See also nudge theory. I've reported on that. I've talked about that on this podcast. It's an open secret. The book is out there, written by two guys who were in the Biden-Obama administration. It's called Nudge Theory. They're very open and honest about their dishonesty. Like, they will tell you right to their face that they are going to manipulate you for your own good because you're dumb and they're smart. We have here a concern that capitalism is the problem. Jim Hoft reports that Kerry promoted the WEF's launch of its First Movers Coalition. That's what they're calling it, First Movers Coalition, which he said was, quote, needed to create demand signals in the market where they didn't exist, which takes boldness, it takes courage from these executives who have made the decision to be a part of this. In other words, you're manipulating the market. That's not a new thing. And it's just like a lot of the jargon, you know, I was studying Al Gore and his TED Talks and his push of an inconvenient truth several years ago when I was writing a series of articles for On the Rocks blog. The more you dig into this whole sustainability, Green New Deal, Green Revolution, green business model stuff, you know, the more it sounds like some very old business principles, like, for instance, keep your costs low if you want to maximize profits, like, for instance, recycling so you can reduce waste. That's no new thing. But John Kerry says in his speech at COP27, and I quote, we have an enormous challenge before us to bring to scale new technologies and to harness the deeply capable capacity of private sector entrepreneurs in order to bring them to the table, because without it, no government has enough money. We need everybody behind this. You know, here's the trouble, right? Harnesses are for horses and pack animals and oxen. Harnesses are for poor, dumb animals that you're just using. And the trouble with regarding people, men, women, and children, as dumb animals that you need to nudge into doing what you think is best for them, the trouble is if they say, no, I'm a person, show some respect, mind your own business, you start doing the things to get rid of those poor, dumb animals that you would if they were actually poor, dumb animals. And then we're full circle. And this is not altruism, and this is not, again, any new thing under the sun. This goes right back in a jiffy to the same kinds of things that dictators and strongmen and world conquerors have always been willing to do to make examples of people who get in their way. That is, you murder the folks who are not willing to get with the program. You know, it's curious. You get this Klaus Schwab character. He's getting up there, and his second point, which I'll play for you, his second point in establishing the framework for their getting together, this B20, G20 conference in Indonesia, this most recent one from earlier this month, there's talk of this fourth industrial revolution. I'm going to play the clip, and then I'll explain what that actually is. He won't tell you, but I'll tell you. Take a listen.
Now, my second point relates to the fourth industrial revolution, the minister mentioned. When I wrote the book about the fourth industrial revolution and conceptualized the idea of this revolution, I described 23 technologies. And at that time, only 5 years ago, many of those technologies were considered science fiction. Today, they all have become realities, and new technologies we have to deal with. Quantum technology, the metaverse, and I'm very proud that Indonesia is again one of the countries which wants to ride at the forefront of those developments of the fourth industrial revolution. What makes the fourth industrial revolution different? Three things. First, it's the scope. Contrary to earlier technological innovation, it doesn't deal with one or two innovations. It's a whole panoply of technologies which interact and which completely will change how we produce, how we consume, how we communicate. But the second element is the speed. And if you look at technological revolutions, it usually goes in the form of an S-curve. And just now, we are at the inflection point to exponential development. And technology will change completely what we are doing at this present time. And not only what we are doing, and that's another change, it will change and it will have an impact on even who we are. Just look how even the internet has changed to a certain extent our identities over the last 20 years. I'm very proud that the forum is also at the forefront of those new technologies, and we will showcase even here in the context of our presentation of the Ocean 20 initiative how you can use the metaverse in order to create much deeper and much more extensive and comprehensive global dialogues.
From Wikipedia, Schwab has authored or co-authored several books. Some consider him to be, quote, an evangelist for stakeholder capitalism. The Fourth Industrial Revolution, the subject of a 2016 book he wrote, is another of ideas he has popularized. In January 2017, Stephen Poole in The Guardian criticized Schwab's Fourth Industrial Revolution book, pointing out that the Internet of Things would probably be hackable. He also criticized Schwab for showing that future technologies may be used for good or evil, but not taking a position on the issues, instead offering only vague policy recommendations. The Financial Times innovation editor found the clunking lifelessness of the prose led him to, quote, suspect this book really was written by humans, ones who inhabit a strange twilight world of stakeholders, externalities, inflection points, and developatory sandboxes, end quote. The political scientist Klaus Gerd Giesen has argued that the dominant ideology of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is transhumanism. What is transhumanism? You may be asking or wondering. Essentially, it is becoming more or less cyborgs, becoming no longer really human in the way that we think of human beings transcending our humanity. Well, in some sense, that's also shedding our humanity. That's becoming inhuman. What are we when we're no longer human? That's an important question. The answer some people come to is dead. We're dead. More machine than man at a certain point. The answer that some others come to, who are rather more rosy about it, is we become gods. Now, that's very hubristic. Actually, that is why God confused the languages in Genesis. You know, Ben Shapiro has a great piece. If you're a subscriber at the Daily Wire, you can read the whole thing. But he quotes at the very beginning in his piece, The Real Story of the Great Reset, Genesis 11, 1 through 9. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there, and they said to one another, come, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in heaven, and let us make ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And God came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men were building. And God said, behold, they are one people, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing will be withheld from them, everything they intend to do. Come, let us descend and confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So God scattered them abroad from there upon the face of all the earth, and they abandoned building the city. Therefore, the name of it was called Babel, because God did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did God scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth. This is why he did it. And what are we trying to do? We are trying to build another Tower of Babel. We are trying to make a name for ourselves, and we are trying to make it where nothing is impossible for us apart from God. It's hubris. It's disastrous. It will not end in godhood. It will end in destruction and death and judgment. You know, I think to myself here about the difference, on the one hand, between the ideology of Klaus Schwab, the G20, the B20, the O20 soon to come, the globalists, the WEF, the international bankers, the men who think they've got a better idea and they can play God. I think of the contrast between that and this idea of just saving my beloved and my child. That's what I'm fighting for. That's what I fight for. That's what I die for. That's what I'm here for. That's what I'm about. In some future episodes, which I think will be a great deal easier to record once we're not sick, hopefully that's going to be very shortly, I want to talk about The Case for Christian Nationalism, Stephen Wolfe's book. I've started reading it. I've been listening to some interviews that he's done with Jared Longshore and Doug Wilson, some back and forth conversation Doug Wilson's had with James White over the question. I've been discussing it also with my friends at TRC and IGV. One of the points that I really am tickled to hear Stephen Wolfe articulating so far, that I recently realized is my own position. Actually, before I came across him articulating it, I had to articulate it myself because I was discussing some things with my friend Alex Cassetta along these lines. And one of the things I recently realized I believe, which Stephen Wolfe also articulates, is that nations, separate, distinct nations, are not a result of the fall. Why would we suppose that they are? Just because they're always corrupt or they always misbehave? It's like saying that marriage is a result of the fall just because there's not going to be marriage in the kingdom come, or just because we've only ever seen imperfect marriages. Parenting and having children, that's a result of the fall because we've only ever seen misbehaving children and parents that are at a loss or heavy-handed or out to lunch. Marriage, parenting, those are good gifts from the Lord God Almighty. And it's good also that I'm not the father of all the children in the world. I'm the father of these 8 children. And I'm not the husband to every woman in the world. I'm the husband to this one woman. That's good. That's right. That's proper. It's very closely related to my finitude. It's also very okay that my household, my parenting, my marriage is not going to look identical to every other Christian marriage, every other Christian parent-child relationship. Well, so also, if we extrapolate out and up into nations being separate and distinct, it's not a result of the fall and sin that you would have facilitators, organizers of tribes, of peoples, to a good purpose, and that God would be glorified in the diversity that is legitimate, that is appropriate, the creativity, being fruitful and multiplying, filling the earth and subduing it, the opposite of what the Tower of Babel folks wanted to do. They wanted to not spread out all over the world. They wanted to bunch up. Let's just stay right here and let's become gods, more or less. It's appropriate that we would have separate nations. And I would say that a Christian cannot be for the abolition of nations, generally speaking. Certainly not by human means. If God wants to abolish nations, that's his prerogative, and we get out of his way, or we say amen. Let it be. So be it. But we should not be for the abolition of nations any more than we should be for the abolition of families. What's going to replace it? It's an or what question. And if you read to the end, the or what with a one-world government is oppressive, tyrannical, totalitarian, anti-Christ, anti-church, anti-Christian. That's their idea of inclusivity. That's their idea of diversity. That's their idea of equity, is saying to the Christians and to the church, submit or die. Again, I say, this is Bond supervillain stuff right here. Also, again, just to reiterate that I'm not making this up as far as what's being advocated being communism. It really is. I mean, definitionally, what's being proposed, redistribution of wealth, a one-world government, it is communism. DEI is communism. But there's this video, actually, of Klaus Schwab from a documentary called The Forum from 2019. He's being interviewed in what looks like his office, his library. There's definitely a bust of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin on the shelf right behind him. There's books. There's a vase, a rather attractive vase, actually, of a tiger in the snow. And there's a bust. There's a little statue, a little idol of Lenin. Should we be surprised? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. What's the solution? What's the response? Well, going back to the topic of our last couple of episodes, this is one of the reasons why a lot of folks who want to vote for Trump are onto something. They do have something to go on. It does seem as though he has been one to push back against the globalists like nobody else in our lifetime. I think that's why they hate him. I think that's what he's been a kind of common grace for us in doing, to assert national self-interest, which is not wicked any more than saying, I'm going to do what's in my family's interest is wicked. Again, I refer you back to No Time to Die. James Bond saving the world. What is that? Great. Nothing new. Good job. James Bond saving his beloved and his child and dying to save them. Well, that, on the other hand, that I will weep for. Enjoy. I mean, sadness that he is gone, but enjoy that that's good. That's right. That's proper. Trump being a tragic hero, if he is the nominee, if he gets the Republican nomination, it won't be the worst thing ever. I don't know that it would be the best that we can do. I favor DeSantis. DeSantis, for his part, was asked what his thoughts were on this whole business with the WEF, G20, B20. Here's what he had to say.
I want to have the values not of Davos imposed on us, but of places like Destin and Dunedin, where I grew up. Things like the World Economic Forum, those policies are dead on arrival in the state of Florida. We are not going to go down that road.
There you go. There you go. That's all it takes, is just say no. Just say no to communism, kids. just say no. My family, my home, my property, my liberty does not need to be redistributed to the whole world. That's death. That's not a better life. That's no life at all. That's not transhumanism. That's inhuman. It's villainy if you're going to try and impose it. But we don't have to be an expert on the whole world over to know right from wrong here, to know truth from falsehood. We don't have to be an expert. I don't think we have to be a seasoned billionaire businessman to be able to say, no, not on my watch. Actually, I think the single biggest thing that we can do is come to Jesus, put your faith in Christ, be reading God's word, have your mind and your heart transformed and made alive by the word of God, by the power of God, by the grace of God. Young people, study, develop a good work ethic, marry well someone who loves the Lord. The two of you love the Lord together, love one another, have children, raise those children to love the Lord, to love one another, to love the people around you. That's the single greatest thing we can do to push back on what's being imposed or what's being attempted. That's what God calls us to. It's a good, decent, beautiful, true thing. We don't need permission. We have it already. So I got to run. I'm going to lay down for my part because I didn't sleep very well last night. More to come. I definitely need to tell you more about these things in future episodes. In particular, just a little teaser for what's coming down the pike. I want to talk soon about, for one, a problem with work ethics. Are we developing them or not? Also, on a related note, I think rapidly declining fertility for men in particular. The problem is accelerating. I think these things are related. I don't think it's a coincidence. And I'll just leave you with this. The years being measured to and from 1973 on the one hand, 2018 on the other hand. So something happened in the 1970s and it's been causing a problem ever since 1973. Huh, let's see. What happened in 1973? Let's think about this. Oh, I know. Roe v. Wade, January 22nd, 1973. Recently overturned. Maybe we can overturn the declining work ethic of young people, the declining interest in marriage and having children. Maybe also we can reverse this problem with declining fertility among men in particular. But that's coming up. That's not this episode. Like I said, I gotta run. I'm gonna go rest myself, try and get over being sick, try and get my family over being sick. For now, as always, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless. You've been listening to The Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. For more content like what you just heard, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Also, check out thegarrettashleymulletshow.com to subscribe to email alerts when new episodes are published. As always, you can reach me with any comments, questions, complaints, objections, or insights at garrettashleymullet@protonmail.com.